And Lewis wanted to know what he called patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us, he said. Or Lewis's words on the animal self and the diabolical self, he said that the latter was much worse, and added that that is why a cold, self-righteous prig who goes regularly to church may be far nearer to hell than a prostitute. But of course, he added, it is better to be neither. Today, in a lecture sponsored and convocation sponsored by Mrs. Larry Bielenberg's parents, Mr. and Mrs. R.B. McGrew, we at Concordia Seminary are very privileged to have with us Father Walter Hooper, who will speak on the increasing relevance of C.S. Lewis. Father Hooper is eminently qualified. A native of North Carolina who took a master's degree at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill, his contact with C.S. Lewis began almost 30 years ago. He first visited Lewis in 1963, and such a close friendship ensued that he very shortly became Lewis's companion secretary. After the very unexpected passing of this apologist for the Christian faith, Father Hooper read theology at Oxford, entered the priesthood, and served as chaplain at two Oxford colleges. In 1969, Father Hooper was appointed a trustee of Lewis's estate, and shortly thereafter resigned his chaplain's post in order that he might give himself more completely to editing Lewis's works and also to his responsibility as one of the trustees. For the past 11 years, he's been attached to the Church of St. Mary Magdalene, where, freed from most pastoral duties, he continues this important work. I am pleased and honored to present Father Walter Hooper.
Reverend Principal, Reverend Sirs, ladies and gentlemen, those who have read what is generally recognized to be the best biography in the world, James Boswell's Life of Dr. Samuel Johnson, will recall that Boswell, a Scotsman, had long wished to meet Dr. Johnson. Like so many others, he admired the dictionary and the other writings of Dr. Johnson, but knowing little about the everyday habits of the great man, he imagined that Dr. Johnson lived, as Boswell says in his diary, in a state of solemn, elevated abstraction. In fact, Dr. Johnson was a poor and exceedingly slovenly man, and those who knew him would have doubtless been amused by the notion of Johnson, of all men, in a state of solemn abstraction. Even so, there was one thing which Boswell had no doubts about. Dr. Johnson was notoriously prejudiced against anybody and almost anything Scottish. Nevertheless, Boswell persevered in his attempt to meet the author of the first dictionary of the English language, an effort which seemed doomed to failure until they met by chance in the bookshop of one Mr. Davis. "Don't tell him where I come from," Boswell whispered to Davis. "From Scotland," cried Davis to Dr. Johnson. "Mr. Johnson," said Boswell, "I do indeed come from Scotland, but I cannot help it." "That, sir," replied Johnson coldly, "I find is what a very great many of your countrymen cannot help." However, as everyone knows, Dr. Johnson became very fond of the younger man, and their friendship is, in its own way, as famous as the biography. While I share none of Boswell's varied talents, I resembled him in two respects. The first was my admiration for the books of C.S. Lewis, and the fact that I longed for years to see the man whose books had done more than any others to shape my mind, and which then as well as now are the chief source of my happiness. The other resemblance is that I was to Lewis as Boswell was to Dr. Johnson, a foreigner. My origins go back to North Carolina, and after corresponding with C.S. Lewis for 10 years, I received an invitation to visit him in Oxford. I was lecturing on English literature at the University of Kentucky when the invitation came. Whether this invitation was a single visit to see Lewis, I did not know. As it turned out, I was invited back and back to Lewis's home, The Kills, until in July of 1963, I was asked to move into Lewis's house as his companion and private secretary. Like Boswell, I thought of Lewis as living in a state of solemn, elevated abstraction until I first saw the interior of The Kills and learned that it was quite the opposite. "Don't worry about an ashtray," said Lewis. "Just flick your ashes on the floor." "Ashes are good for rugs, but only men believe it." Before I moved in as Lewis's secretary, I had a visit which I recall with particular vividness. Lewis was a man of very great merriment, and he was, like Dr. Johnson, a notable tea drinker. Not for Lewis, the delicate, fluted, small cups so beloved of Victorian ladies. Lewis took his cups by the pint. And on this occasion, not only did cup follow cup, but a pot followed pot. Until this time, I had never stayed for so long a visit. And because I was living in a hotel, I had not realized that in most English homes, the bathroom and the lavatory, that is the toilet, are separate rooms. And so it was that after drinking what seemed gallons of tea, nature was determined to have her say, and I asked to be shown the bathroom. "Certainly," said Lewis, who took me to what indeed was the bathroom. After putting out several tablets of soap, he flung down a pile of towels. Then, after inquiring if there was anything else I needed, he closed the door behind me. Did he, I wondered, really suppose I wanted to get into that tub? Could I go back and explain that a tub of water was the last thing on my mind? After hesitating for some time, I returned to confess that it was not a bath I wanted. "Well, sir," said Lewis, bursting with laughter, "choose you this day. That will break you of those silly American euphemisms. And now, where is it you wanted to go?" I believe it is more revealing about Lewis than it is about me that although I knew Lewis only during the last 6 months before his death in November 1963, the impression he made upon me is still, after nearly 20 years, not only as great as it was from the beginning, but one that affects me more deeply as the years pass. No doubt this is bound up to some extent with the fact that I've spent the last 20 years editing Lewis's literary remains. Even so, I know that even had I not been allowed this high privilege, I would, whatever I might be doing, never have lost any of my enthusiasm for Lewis's writings. But those of us who knew Lewis personally cannot be the total measure, or anything like it, of the immense impact of the man in his writings. And that, because here I am among so many others who feel as I do, and learn, I suppose, more than Mr. and Mrs. Brownell McGrew, whose extraordinary generosity has brought us together under one roof. Before going on to what I've called the increasing relevance of C.S. Lewis, there are a couple of things I should like to say about the man himself. This partly because I believe they shed light on the relevance I have in mind. Actually, they're answers to the two questions people most frequently ask me about Lewis. I think the one most frequently asked is, what did Lewis think of his own books? Did he talk about them? Lewis seemed interested in everything. Still, for all that, the thing he seemed to have the least interest in was himself. Of his own books, I recall seeing no more than a half dozen in the house, and even they had the look of fugitives, books which had somehow lost their way and survived only because they got mixed up with the several thousand which made up Lewis's library. It was for me a great day when I came across a copy of Lewis's The Allegory of Love, when I complained that it contained not one word of marginalia. Lewis said, but isn't it enough to write a book without having to read it? But Lewis would talk, always, I think, as a kindness to me, about the contents of his own works. It amuses me even now to imagine how our conversation about Lewis's books might be interpreted by someone who could have overheard us. Such a stranger could not have supposed me intelligent enough to have written them. He would suppose Lewis intelligent enough to have written them, but Lewis spoke of his own books with such detachment that I believe the only conclusion the stranger could arrive at was that Lewis and I both knew the author, but that I was better acquainted with the insides of the books than Lewis. Of one thing I'm sure, there was no inverted snobbery in Lewis's detachment. He had a phenomenal memory, and so naturally knew what he had written. This I realized when we sometime got onto a specific character or a specific book. I have heard Lewis roar with laughter over the marshwiggle Puddleglum from the Narnian Tales, and that because Lewis enjoyed this very engaging character as so many of us do, not because he was Puddleglum's inventor. On another occasion, having heard me going on about his interplanetary trilogy, he asked which was my favorite. I told him it was That Hideous Strength. And when asked why, I said because it was the longest of the three. Really, said Lewis. I like it for the same reason. Oh, I do like long books. On one time, I mentioned how perfect something was expressed in one of Lewis's poems, and I quoted the entire poem by heart. Because he was knocking out his pipe, he failed to catch the name of the author, but he heard the poem, and that he obviously enjoyed very much, because as soon as I had finished quoting, he exclaimed, "Hey, that's good. Oh, that is a corker. Do you perchance know the author or where I could lay my hands on that poem?" Then we really did laugh when I said I did indeed know the author, but whose name went unheard by the knocking out of the author's pipe by the author himself in the author's home. Other question I am frequently asked is whether or not Lewis and I ever disagreed about anything. And the answer is that while Lewis and I never argued about anything, we held different opinions about one matter. It came about this way. One day we were talking about the resurrection of literary works, and Lewis expressed delight that the books of one of his favorite authors, Sir Walter Scott, were, after years of neglect, being rediscovered and undergoing a kind of resurrection. When I predicted that his own books would suffer no decline, he cautioned me against putting too high a value on them. Indeed, he tried to modulate my enthusiasm by pointing out that after an author's death, the general rule is that the sales of his book fall drastically and eventually dry up altogether. But sometimes, not by any means always, he said, an author's works undergo a kind of resurrection, but that is something no author can count on. As I've tried to make clear, Lewis was almost without opinions about his own books. Even so, he believed, and said so, that after his death, his books would quickly be forgotten. This had nothing to do with vanity, insofar as it worried him. It was only because his elder brother had long depended upon him, and Lewis had good reason to worry as to what his brother would live on when Lewis himself was dead. I understood why he had reason to worry, but I nevertheless felt that Lewis's worries were unfounded, and I said so. As I went on to say, despite Lewis's blushes, I could not believe that the human race, fashion conscious as it is even about theological works, or perhaps especially about theological works, such a world could never be so stupid and thick-headed as to not ever not enjoy and depend upon Lewis's books as much as I did and do. But Lewis was more knowledgeable than I about the spiritual bankrupts that we all see around us. And I shall never forget what Lewis said about that. Our civilization, he said, was built upon Christian morals and nourished by the faith of the apostles. It was rather like a huge bank account to which many contributed and which everyone has drawn upon. Now we know you cannot go on writing checks on that account unless you add to its capital. The trouble is that without adding to that capital, we continue to write checks. One day that capital will run out. The question of building up and retaining this spiritual capital, or the faith once delivered to the saints, has been before the church since the first century, as everyone who has any knowledge of church history, of course, knows. But there's one very significant difference between the early converts to whom Saints Peter and Paul were writing their epistles and the modern unbelievers whom Lewis and indeed all of us now meet. This important difference C.S. Lewis clarified in a short but very valuable essay entitled God in the Dark. Writing about the difficulties he himself faced in trying to present the Christian faith to modern unbelievers, Lewis said this: "The greatest barrier I've met is the almost total absence from the minds of my audience of any sense of sin. This creates for us a new situation. The early Christian preachers could assume in their hearers, whether Jews, Metuentes, as you know, are Judaizing Gentiles, or pagans, a sense of guilt. Thus, the Christian message was in these days unmistakably the Evangelium, the good news. It promised healing to those who knew they were sick. We have to convince our hearers of the unwelcome diagnosis before we can expect them to welcome the news of the remedy. The ancient man approached God, or even the gods, as the accused approaches his judge. For the modern man, the roles are reversed. He is the judge. God is in the dock. He is quite a kindly judge if God should have a reasonable defense for being the God who permits war, poverty, and disease. He is ready to listen to it. The trial may even end in God's acquittal. But the important thing is that man is on the bench and God is in the dock. My own experiences suggest that if we can awake the consciences of our hearers at all, we must do so in quite different directions. In other words, the good news, the faith once, that faith which comes to us from the apostles, the everlasting gospels, always is and always remains the same. The methods of getting it across must vary with the times. I may not have read as much in the way of modern theological approaches as many in this audience. Even so, given what I do know, it is my belief that no one in this century has done as much as Lewis in getting the gospel into people's heads and causing it to stay there. At this point, I think it in order to talk a little about Lewis's early life, which it seems to me cannot finally be separated from the explanation of Lewis's extraordinary effectiveness as a transmitter of the gospel to this generation. Besides Lewis's own autobiography and what seems a never-ending avalanche of books about him, there is nevertheless one area of his life not much noticed, which I believe goes a long way towards explaining why Lewis has so deservedly won the ears of millions of readers throughout the world. I doubt if I am the only one in this room who was a little surprised by the opening sentence of Lewis's first work of straight theology, The Problem of Pain, which begins, "Not many years ago when I was an atheist." Besides being true, it is eye-catching as one thinks, well, here's one apologist who sees things from both positions, as an unbeliever and as a believer. Still, I was even more intrigued when, after Lewis's death, I read the diary he wrote between the years 1919 and 1929, and the letters he wrote to his boyhood friend Arthur Greaves, which letters are now published under the title They Stand Together. At first it was hard to believe that the man I found so in love with and beholden to God could be the author of such a diary. In it, there's evidence enough, if one needed it, of Lewis's competence as a writer with a first-class mind, but proof, too, of the pride which Lewis was later to regard as his besetting sin. Before I'd finished reading, I felt almost smothered by Lewis's ambition to be a great poet, or if not that, famous no matter what it cost him, no matter what it cost others. And inseparable from this overwhelming ambition to be a great writer was the frustration of not being able to create anything to be famous for. Time after time, he records, having sent poems to magazines, and time after time came the usual rejection slips. Amongst the papers dating from this same period are several beginnings of very dull novels. None, so it would seem, ever completed for the sole reason that Lewis had nothing to say. As Jacob had wrestled with the angels, so it appeared that Lewis was too occupied wrestling with fame to exercise the latent talents within him. It may be answered by many non-Christians that many non-Christians have written very good books, and we can only speculate about what kind of writer Lewis may have been, if one at all, had not God omitted Lewis's no trespassing sign. From what Lewis published about God's invasion, as well as what is in Lewis's diary, it appears quite certain that God intended to withhold from Lewis the ability to do anything worthwhile with the talents he had until Lewis submitted to the death of all ambition. The end of this long rebellion against God, Lewis is described in Surprise by Joy. "You must picture me," Lewis wrote, "alone in that room in Magdalen, night after night, feeling, whenever my mind lifted even for a second from my work, the steady, unrelenting approach of him whom I so earnestly desired not to meet. That which I greatly feared had at last come upon me. In the Trinity term of 1929, I gave in and admitted that God was God, and knelt and prayed. Perhaps that night the most dejected and reluctant convert in all England. I did not then see what is now the most shining and obvious thing, the divine humility which would accept a convert on such terms. The prodigal son at least walked home on his own feet. But who can duly adore that love which will open the high gates to a prodigal who is brought in kicking, struggling, resentful, and darting his eyes in every direction for chance of escape. The words compelle entrare, compel them to come in, have been so abused by wicked men that we shudder at them. But properly understood, They plumb the depths of the divine mercy. The hardness of God is kinder than the softness of men, and his compulsion is our liberation. Lewis's conversion to theism was only the first step, as he still could not understand how Christ fitted into the picture. Still, one effect of this liberation by God was that Lewis was no longer enslaved to that old cheat faith. Notice what happened. Shortly after his conversion to theism, Lewis received a despairing letter from Arthur Greaves, a man of very small literary ability, who had been advised by a kind friend that he would never succeed as a writer. In his reply of the 18th August 1930, Lewis said to his heartbroken friend, "Do you, no doubt, at the moment it seems that to read your own book in print and to have it liked by a few friends would be ample bliss, whether one bought it or not. Believe me, Arthur, this is an absolute delusion. It might satisfy you for a moment, but very soon, if it didn't sell, you would find yourself just as disappointed as you are now. So that in this sense, I am still as disappointed an author as you. From the age of 16 onwards, I had one single ambition, from which I never wavered, in the prosecution of which I spent every ounce I could, on which I really and deliberately staked my whole contentment. And I recognize myself as having unmistakably failed in it. The side of me which longs not to write, for no one can stop us doing that, but to be approved as a writer, is not the side of us that is really worth much. And depend upon it, unless God has abandoned us, he will find means to cauterize that somehow or other. If we can take the pain well and truly now, and by it forever get over the wish to be distinguished beyond our fellows, well. If not, we shall get it again in some other form, and honestly, the being cured with all the pain has pleasure too. One creeps home, tired and bruised, into a state of mind that is really restful. When all one's ambitions have been given up, then one can really for the first time say, 'Thy kingdom come,' for in that kingdom there will be no preeminences, and a man must have reached the state of not caring two straws about his own status before he can reach it." Arthur fortunately received Lewis's advice with gratitude. A little later, the 28th August 1930, Lewis wrote again about what had happened within himself. "As for the real motives for writing," he said to Arthur, "after one has got over the desire for acknowledgments in the first place, I found and find that precisely at the moment you have really put all that out of your mind and decided not to write again, precisely then the ideas, which came so rarely in the days when you regarded yourself officially as an author, begin to bubble and simmer. And sooner or later, you will have to write. And the question, why, won't really enter your mind. In my own case, it is a very remarkable thing that in the few religious lyrics which I have written during the last year, in which I had no idea of publication, and at first very little idea even of showing them to friends, I found myself impelled to take infinitely more pain, less ready to be contented with the fairly good, and more determined to reach the best attainable than ever I was in the days when I wrote without the ardent hope of successful publications." The religious lyrics Lewis mentioned to Greaves were later to appear in an allegorical account of his conversion, The Pilgrim's Regress. My belief is that they comprise some of the most beautiful and indeed important poems he was ever to write. What's more, Lewis's marvelous sense of humor, so long stifled by his passion to be famous, made a return in these poems. always intrigued by dragons. There's one poem spoken through the mouth of an aging and arthritic dragon. In acknowledging his faults to God, he makes one confession which Lewis's lifelong friend Arthur Owen Barfield tells me he always finds the one line in English poetry which never fails to cheer him up. The dragon, explaining to God why he is a widower, says, "Often I wish I had not eaten my wife." It will be remembered that Lewis was still only a theist, and this because he could not see how Christ fitted into Christianity. The answer, which had eluded him so long, came on the evening of the 19th September 1931, when Lewis invited his friends J.R. Tolkien and Hugo Dyson to dine with him at Magdalen College. Both men knew that Lewis had for years dismissed Christ as mythology, one more instance of the great many instances in various mythologies of a dying and reviving God. After dinner, the three men were to talk all night in Lewis's rooms. Then, writing to Arthur Greaves on the 18th October 1931 about this momentous occasion, Lewis explained, "What I couldn't see was how the life and death of someone else, whoever he was, 2,000 years ago, could help us here and now, except insofar as his example helped us. And then the example business, though true and important, is not Christianity. Right in the center of Christianity, in the Gospels and in St. Paul, you keep on getting something quite different and mysterious expressed in those phrases I have so long ridiculed. Propitiation, sacrifice, the blood of the Lamb. Expressions which I could only interpret in senses that seemed to me either silly or shocking. Now what Dyson and Tolkien showed me was this, that if I met the idea of sacrifice in a pagan story, I didn't mind it at all. Again, if I met the idea of a God sacrificing himself to himself, I liked it very much and was mysteriously moved by it. Again, that the idea of the dying and reviving God, Balder, Adonis, Bacchus, similarly moved me, provided I met it anywhere except in the Gospels. The reason was that in pagan stories, I was prepared to feel the myth as profound and suggestive of meanings beyond my grasp, even though I could not say in cold prose what it meant. Now, the story of Christ is simply a true myth, a myth working on us in the same way as the others, but with this tremendous difference, that it really happened." Judging from the trouble God had taken over Lewis, and of course everyone born into this world, it apparently makes a great deal of difference to God, as opposed to many demythologizing professors of theology in Oxford, whose ears I should very much like to box, whether one regards the divine Son as a subject to be discoursed upon endlessly, or as the one whose nature simply is what it is, whether we know it or not, whether we like it or not. In any event, the final piece fell into place for Lewis very soon after this all-night talk with Tolkien and Dyson. On the 28th September 1931, Lewis and his brother Warren took a picnic lunch to Whipsnade Zoo, Warren driving his motorcycle with Lewis riding in the sidecar. "When we set out," Lewis was later to recall, "I did not believe that Jesus Christ is the Son of God. But when we reached the zoo, I did. Yet I had not exactly spent the journey nor in great emotion. It was more like a man, after long sleep, still lying motionless in bed, becomes aware that he is now awake. Once awake," there is a theme which is repeated again and again throughout Lewis's writings, which seems to get at the heart of all that he was to write. It finds its fullest expression in his essay on Christianity and Literature. There, Lewis points out that the New Testament has absolutely nothing to say about those traits so beloved of many contemporary writers: creative, spontaneous, and in particular, original. In the New Testament, originality, Lewis argued, is quite plainly the prerogative of God alone. Our whole destiny, Lewis wrote, seemed to lie in the opposite direction, in being as little as possible ourselves, in acquiring a fragrance that is not our own, but borrowed, in becoming clean mirrors, filled with the image of a face that is not ours. He goes on to point out that the key word in the New Testament is not originality, but imitation, imitation of Christ. And this most certainly means, as Lewis states, that for those given the talents for whatever they can do best, the right approach is to ask not, is it mine, but is it good? Before any of his famous books were written, Lewis had been trying to find a suitable form to tell the story of joy or intense longing in his life. This began as far back as 1924 when he succeeded in publishing a short poem entitled Joy, the only one he did succeed with. The trouble was that while Lewis recognized this longing to be common to everyone, he did not understand whither it led. This he cannot be blamed for, as he had not been converted and so could not see that it was really Christ that we want in all our wantings. When he did understand what it was all about, the pilgrim's regress, so Lewis was to say, spurted out of him during a mere fortnight holiday with Arthur Grease in the summer of 1932. It is an allegorical account of Lewis's conversion, but it is not an easy book for some of the brethren. My advice is that for those who have difficulty in following it, and you shouldn't, the best thing to do is to go direct to the story of Lewis later was to retell, Surprised by Joy. The Pilgrim's Regress was followed in 1936 by the work which firmly established Lewis as a great critic in his chosen field of medieval and Renaissance literature. The book is the allegory of love, a history, a study in medieval tradition, which he began as far back as 1928. Those in this audience who have read it will, I think, have noticed that here, too, one meets that deft and certain touch characteristic of all Lewis's books. It is in part a prose style exactly suited to what he had to say, and a style so clean and pleasant that many who would otherwise never read books of this sort have nevertheless turned to Lewis's works of scholarship for one what might identify simply as a most pleasant taste or mouthwash. But I have another reason for mentioning Lewis's works of literary scholarship. Since Lewis's death, I don't think I've read many works about him in which the authors, all Americans, have not made much ado about Lewis having had no formal training in theology. If by theology they mean that he had not read the, to my mind, confused and incomprehensible books of Altizer and the other fashion setters, then the answer is no. If, on the other hand, they mean that he hadn't read St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine, Richard Hooker, Tyndale, St. Thomas More, Calvin, and Martin Luther, to name only a few, then they are very wrong indeed. The extraordinary thing is that not only had Lewis read so many of such theologians, but as was nearly always the case, he read their complete works, not a passage translated into English from St. Thomas Aquinas, but the entire Summa Theologica, the complete writings of Martin Luther, not his mere table talk. if this qualifying of Lewis's theological credentials seems to you unduly harsh, I beg your pardon. Perhaps you will understand it better when I explain that those who have been so anxious to advertise Lewis's lack of formal credentials were all writing doctoral dissertations in theology, and that, without exception, all chose as their doctoral subject C.S. Lewis himself. It is often remarked that the right person comes along at the right time. In England, where the Battle of Britain is still vivid to so many, Sir Winston Churchill is usually cited as a supreme instance of this in the realm of politics. From all I've said about Lewis's flight from and capture by the Hound of Heaven, it will come as no surprise to you when I submit that Lewis is another instance of the right person at the right time. I think my old friend would accuse me of exaggeration, but then he did not know that the sales of his books, always large, are at least 6 times what they were during his lifetime. It has often amused me to wonder if, when I die and arrive in purgatry, I might manage to slip past those in charge of cleaning me up so that I can yell to Lewis, "Hey, Jack, you were wrong and I was right." It is clear from Lewis's writings that while he was interested in this mysterious business of inspiration and other writers, he was reluctant to talk about it when asked how he came to write his own books. To him, it smacked too much of motive scratching and self-expression. However, later in life, when he could not help but be known as a champion of Orthodox Christianity, he found himself under fierce attack in the pages of the Christian Century from the wildly heretical Dr. Norman Pittenger, who was a professor of theology at General Theological Seminary in New York. The magazine's editor asked Lewis to reply, and for this reason he did. At the very end of his rejoinder to Dr. Pittenger, Lewis said, "When I began, Christianity came before the great mass of my unbelieving countrymen, either in the highly emotional form offered by revivalists, or in the unintelligible language of highly cultured clergymen. Most men were reached by neither. My task was therefore simply that of a translator, one turning Christian doctrine, or what he believed to be such, into the vernacular, into language that unscholarly people would attend to and could understand. One thing at least is sure, if the real theologians had tackled this laborious work of translation about 100 years ago, when they began to lose touch with the people for whom Christ died, there would have been no place for me." Having spent so much time on the background of Lewis, there is not time to consider each of his books in detail. This, however, has been intentional, as I'm given to understand that those who are to follow me in biannual C.S. Lewis convocations will talk about specific books and themes. That being so, I will not intrude upon that which I hope is to come. But I think I should answer as best I can why I think Lewis has become so increasingly relevant. Those like Lewis who espouse the historic faith once delivered to the saints mean by relevant that which is, as the dictionaries say, pertinent, applicable, germane, and to the point. But applicable to what point? Applicable, of course, to that truth Christ entrusted to his apostles, and which St. Vincent of Lerins described as the Christian religion is understood everywhere and by all. In fairness to the modernists, and especially modernist clergymen, I don't know what they mean by relevant, even though it is one of the words they employ most frequently. And I think the reason I don't know is because they don't know. However, judging from the way in which they drop one theological fashion to dash after a newer one, would appear that relevant means not what is true, but whatever is the hottest and most popular theological innovation now. They're like Mexican jumping beans. No one can tell where the bean will jump, as no one can tell what bandwagon the modernists will jump on today, to say nothing of tomorrow. One thing is certain, they seem to believe that what they think of God far greater of far greater importance than what God thinks of them. This makes it easy to manage God, for to them, insofar as they believe in him at all, God is, I think, what you call an open-ended subject to be lectured about, written about, talked about, everything except obeyed and adored. How right Dean Inge was when he said that he who marries the spirit of the age will soon find himself a widower. And how right Lewis when he remarked that all that is not eternal is eternally out of date. Not long ago, when I was being interviewed by the BBC, I was asked which of C.S. Lewis's books I thought most important. I think I surprised my interviewer and myself by answering all. If I'm ever interviewed again, I should probably come back with the same answer. Still, much as I love everything C.S. Lewis wrote, I think his Mere Christianity is in many ways the most important of his books. Those of you who have read or reading theology will probably not like what I'm about to say. Still, it seems to me that until Lewis gave us Mere Christianity, delivered originally in four series of talks over the BBC, the chief impression given the world was that Christianity was something Christians mainly disagreed about. And this, I thought, and still think, chiefly the fault of theologians too absorbed in each of their specialities. Some so narrowly technical that one simply cannot see the wood for the leaves. Perhaps it must be so. Nevertheless, I think we must take very seriously, we can hardly take it seriously enough, that beyond these walls, out there in this city, and thousands of other cities in every country on earth, are millions of people who have never heard the gospel of Christ. I don't mean those who, for whatever reason, won't believe it. I mean those millions who have not the faintest idea what Christianity is about. And to be fair to them, they can hardly be accused of rejecting what they have never been offered. They behave irrelevantly because they don't know what that is to be relevant to. And I think Lewis and Pope Paul VI hit the nail on the head when they proclaim, not Africa, but this whole world, a missionary zone in need of Jesus Christ. The greatest difference between Lewis and the modernists is that Lewis began his apostolate with the assumption that we were not and had not for a long time been living in a Christian civilization. And further, that Christianity consisted of a body of immutable facts, the deposit of faith. The modernists, on the other hand, clergy and laity, have for a long time given a totally different meaning to Christianity. For them, it appears to me, that faith consists not as a body of facts, which is simply there, but something which changes with the times. If no one appeared to believe in the devil, then out goes the devil, despite the fact that our Lord believed in his existence. When the resurrection somehow got in the way, then that too had to be jettisoned. Thus, Christianity becomes whatever you will. And of every new innovation, the question, insofar as innovations are questioned, is not is it true, but how do we fit it in? Recently, we have seen some of the great and most dangerous innovations in the history of the church. I would include among these the unprecedented step of the Episcopal Church in this country of creating an order of priestesses, thus making it impossible ever to reunite those portions of Christendom which retain the apostolic succession. And looming on the sidelines, if not already come into the limelight, is the belief that there is no such thing as objective right and wrong. I believe it is this assumption that you can interpret Christianity so as to accommodate whatever assumptions are in fashion that has caused many of the churches to accept without protest the mortal sin of abortion. In England today, more children are murdered in the womb than are allowed to be born. I understand that in the United States, over 1 million children are thus murdered each year. How can those who say they are still horrified over the 6 million Jews killed by Hitler not see and respond to this? I'm afraid the terrifying truth is that one can get used to anything. To me, the essential glory of Lewis's mere Christianity is that without bitterness or rancor, he presents the whole sweep of Christianity so that it can be seen as a whole. Because he was writing for a very, very diverse audience, he had no choice but to talk about those matters, not which divide the churches, but upon which all are agreed. But then that is possibly the very thing which makes it so uniquely valuable. And yet how much he packs in. I'm sorry to say that until I came here, I had only met 2 Lutheran clergymen. I felt deeply humbled to be told by one of them, the professor of theology at one of the most distinguished universities in the United States, his name I shall never reveal, told me that he'd been teaching theology for some years before he came across Lewis's books and was converted. Another quality much admired in Lewis's writing is his ability to say in his inimitably clean and precise prose just those things which most of us feel with great certainty but cannot put into words. For instance, the dispute, surely familiar to those who have read Luther's works, over faith versus works, has been raging since the first century. I wonder if a 200-page tome on the subject could ever bring the answer any closer than Lewis' statement that this, as he says, seems to be like asking which blade in a pair of scissors is the most necessary. And still there's more. The quality which I regard as the quiddity of Lewis's writings is his ability to answer with a disarming precision I've never met elsewhere those questions which we cannot even ask ourselves, but when answered we realize we have waited for all our lives. I think it was St. Augustine who first formulated the question as to whether Christ was either God or a good man. Never have I come across a more convincing answer, and no doubt your principle too, than the one Lewis gives us in Mere Christianity. Christ says, Lewis wrote, that he is humble and meek, and we believe him, not noticing that if he were merely a man, humility and meekness are the very last characteristics we could attribute to his sayings. I am trying here to prevent anyone saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. That is the one thing we must not say. A man who was merely a man and said the things, the sort of things Jesus said, would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of the man who says he is a poached egg, or he would be the devil of hell. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. You can shut him up for food, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come with any patronizing nonsense about his being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. The gratitude Lewis has received these years since his death is such that I think Time magazine was probably right in saying that Lewis is the most widely read theologian in the Eastern world. One wonders how he would view this. I think I know. There survives a letter from the BBC written when Lewis had quite astonished the British people with his talks on their Christianity. In it, the BBC said that after study of the reaction to Lewis's talks had been taken, the results revealed that the single most important fact is the sharp division you produced in your audience. They obviously either regard you as the cat's whiskers or as beneath contempt, which is interesting. It ought, I feel, to teach us something, but I can't think what. But Lewis knew. And in his reply, he reveals, perhaps better than anywhere else, the motivation of all that he had written and all that he was still to write about the author who had invented him. Responding to the BBC, he said, "The two views you report, cat's whiskers and beneath contempt, aren't very illuminating about me, perhaps. About my subject matter, it is an old story, isn't it? They love or hate." He meant, of course, the everlasting gospel, which he believed himself to be no more than a translator for those who would listen. He saw no reason to be proud of doing what had been given him to do. And not to be overlooked is the pastoral care he lavished on those many who had either been converted by his books, or if already converted, he had helped to remain so. Typically, Lewis always encouraged those who liked him to like someone else more. Thus, this letter to someone who had been brought to Christ by Lewis's books, which I believe he would say to all. As for my part in it, remember that anybody or anything can be used by the Holy Spirit as a conductor. I say this not so much from modesty as to guard against any danger of your feeling when the shine goes out of my books, as it will, that the real thing is in any way involved. It mustn't fade when I do. Thank you very much.
Father Hooper has kindly consented to comment your questions, and we'll let him do the fielding of those questions. So, fire away.
Yes. Maybe I didn't catch it when you were talking about Lewis' struggle with the sacrifice of Christ. What made that so different from the mythological sacrifice and so forth? What caught his eye? Was it that Jesus died for all people? Or?
Well, that in. what he was later to write about in various places, including the Pilgrim's Regress, is that what had bothered him all along was that there were so many reported sayings, like UFOs today, there were so many reported sayings throughout history of a dying and reviving God. And Lewis loved mythologies anyway. And what he had thus concluded was that this is one more instance of that. So how can you really, you know, show that it really makes any difference? But odd enough, he didn't like this one. For instance, as many atheists, you know, would love to, you know, shoot every one of you in this room, especially me. But they nevertheless would allow in their colleges, you know, a study of folklore, or perhaps even Buddhism, but not a believed religion such as Christianity in any case, you know, but a Greek mythology or something like that. And what Lewis eventually saw was that as Christ lighteth every man that cometh into the world, all that had passed before in the pagan religions, all these what he called dim dreams, had been given by God. But they had been distorted because the people didn't know what they meant. But only in the Jewish mythology, that is, in the Old Testament, you know, this is what Lewis would call, they were the chosen people, and so theirs was the chosen mythology. And then he goes on to see the great differences between these is that whereas that God was hinting throughout history, preparing people for this, it finally became fact when Jesus became incarnate as man. I think Lewis's answer, his short essay, the myth became fact, is really far better than this torturous book edited by, I think, John Hick on the mythology of God incarnate, in which they dismissed the whole thing. In fact, they're right back where Lewis started from the beginning. It's very interesting that Lewis at 18 could formulate, you know, what they, theologians, you know, have finally come to believe. But Lewis says, the truth is that if God is going to become man, you would expect the divine hintings to appear. Not just with the Jews as well, but you would expect to get hints of this. Now, what he means by mythology, something like truth in pictorial form. So when you read at Christmas time, you know, parts of Isaiah, Wonderful Counselor, all of these, we are much more moved by those than we are, interesting enough, I think, even by the beginning of St. John's Gospel. And I think Lewis's feeling was that, you know, anything which is hinted, you know, that which is still hovering in the heavens, which has not come down, is always more beautiful than that which has to shed its glory when it becomes fact. Does that answer you?
So, I see two things why in regard to sacrifice is important. In that it became fact, whereas maybe the other mythologies, you couldn't be sure they were fact, and then it was understood, the meaning was not obscure as they were in the other mythologies. Is that correct? Instead of a fact, the meaning wasn't
in spirit. Yes, well, what they showed him was that, I think they really brought him to the point where he saw that, you know, why do you love the others so much? Why do you hate this one so much? You know, if you don't believe it to be true, why do you hate it so much? Why don't you just forget it? But he didn't forget it. And it kept cropping up. Until finally, he did see, as he expressed to them, that the difference between, you know, the fact that Christianity is taken as a sort of poetry or mythology didn't move him as much is because it is not really as romantic as the others. But also there is the fact that he didn't want it to be true either. He fought long and hard. It's very interesting, he told me, his session with one of the Billy Graham people, who was a very nice man who came to interview him for decision. And the questions were constantly put, when did you decide on Christ? And Lewis kept saying, I didn't decide, he decided. No, we must have this in the magazine. You know, when did you make your decision? He said, I didn't make any decisions at all. I didn't want it to happen. I was decided upon. Finally, they were willing to print that. But I think Lewis, the story of his conversion is a very interesting one, because here's a man who really did want to believe. And I think the reason he could write such splendid books on, say, pain and miracles is that he's a man, the modern atheist is so lazy today. You know, I mean, he says he's an atheist, and you say, why? And he doesn't know. We need some other word now. That's too exalted for most atheists today. But Lewis, atheism was very strong. When he went up to University College in 1919, I mean, there were students still alive who remembered him as being the most blaspheming and embarrassing atheist they had ever met. But at least he really went on about these questions of pain and miracles. And so, in one way, all of his years as an atheist paid off a great deal, because he could see it from their side. As he told me, he said, you know, the ex-atheist in me is extremely annoyed by the modern atheism, you know, which just has no substance to it. At least I, you know, fought hard. They didn't do anything. Yes. Yes. Well, the World's Last Night and Other Essays, they were written for different periodicals. And it was not actually Lewis's intention to publish them in a book. That came from Harcourt Brace of New York. I think Lewis simply agreed on which ones to put in, but he didn't add a preface or anything. And in consequence, it's a book which... he never remembered having written it all. It came as a surprise to him when I mentioned it, because he said he'd never heard of it. I'll ask you one. Have I been too hard on the modernist? Yes. Yes, very well indeed. Much more popular than ever before. I mean, people in England show their enthusiasm very differently about things than the Americans do. I think Americans on the whole feel that if they are excited about something, then let's do something about it, like form a club and talk about it. Well, that happens to a certain extent in Oxford. I mean, we have thousands of clubs, but they're mainly clubs by people, you know, who've been dead several hundred centuries, you know. Normally one does not start a club about someone so recent. Though I've never met a chap who's come up to Oxford University who wasn't brought up on the Narnian stories. They all seem to be very well read. And Lewis, I think, is being rediscovered by a new generation now. I think one of the reasons is that his imaginative approach, which he uses in the science fiction works and in the Narnian stories, seems to really be exactly right. Lewis went at his, say, his apologetics from many different angles, like Screwtape, you know, looking at it from this angle. What do men look like, say, from a certain point of view? What do we look like to them? And then in his in his science fiction trilogy, he really turns the tables on most of what had been going on before that. Instead of making all the people on other planets terrible, you know, much worse than we are, and thus glorifying ourselves, he turned it around and made them, you know, unfallen, and how different they seem to a fallen observer. And with Narnia, I think he probably has succeeded, you know, even he saw the great success of those stories. But I myself feel that it's very dangerous to push too hard. I would not, if I had children, do any more than read them to those children. I wouldn't say this equals so and so. Because as theologians, you must know that it really won't hold water theologically. I mean, it really is an imaginative approach. It's the best he could do. You know, what might Christ be like if he appeared in this imaginary country? And I think some harm is being done by those who have said, you know, this equals that and this equals that, and they don't really know enough theology to understand this. For instance, I would ask myself, you know, Aslan appears to be omniscient, and omniscient before he is killed by the White Witch, and he is so after her death. I mean, after he's been killed, what really is the difference? But Lewis is actually plowing up the sort of field of the imagination so you can respond to these things. But the goodness inherent in his books is not always just in those analogies or parallels. One finds it in so many other places too. Yes.
You mentioned that you're still editing some of his works. I'm wondering if you can tell us what you expect yet to be published.
The most recent one over here is a book called On Stories, another Essays on Literature. And then I think when I get back, I'm expected to begin work, and it will be hard work, I think, on Lewis's Juvenilia. There still survive the stories which he wrote as a child. Began when he was about 6 and went on till he was about 15. He created a whole world, and the people that were characters, animals, and then wrote individual histories of some of them. And we've decided that probably, you know, they are not, of course, as great as the Narnian stories after all, but they are really remarkable for a young boy. And so I think I'll be working on those next. Well, he seemed to displease many fundamentalists by not believing in, say, the inerrancy of Scripture in the sense that everything, I may be misquoting them, but, you know, sort of written by the finger of God. But his own belief was that something like the Book of Job, for instance, may not have been historically accurate. I mean, Cecil B. DeMille, or one of your other film producers, may not have, you know, been able to actually film the whole thing. But that doesn't mean that it's not inspired. Something can be inspired without it having to be historical fact. But I think he felt that the fundamentalist, you know, went too far in this. Because after all, if you read the Church Fathers, you realize that the inerrancy of Scripture, as it's interpreted, I think, by people today, I don't think it's ever been believed in. I mean, I actually happen, like Lewis, to be one of those few people, maybe I'm the only one here, who I believe that the Adam and Eve, that the actual Adam and Eve probably is accurate. Because I don't see why you cannot have both a unique creation, this is what Lewis thought, as well as evolution, though probably evolution will turn out to be quite different from what they now say it is, and that, well, of course, it's always changing. I don't see why you couldn't have a unique creation and then have the rest of the creation coming along at a different pace.
Yeah,
But anyway, it would appear to me that if you regarded that as myth, as the way Lewis did, you would receive all the good from it. You know, myth is sort of, you know, truth in pictorial form. If you don't really believe it, then the whole story is about the fall of man. If you really want confirmation of that, all you have to do is take out a mirror and look into it. If that's not enough, all you have to do is ask the man sitting beside you. Yes. He believes that Jesus is the only way to salvation, but he does make a point in Mere Christianity that regarding those who have never heard the gospel of Christ, and this presents us with a very different matter. He does not see why those who have never had the chance to ever have heard of Christ, like Plato and Aristotle and a great many people today. The question, you know, for him was, you know, that they must, in Christ is the only salvation there is. But it may be that for many of these people, it will have to happen after death, when the choice will then be open to them. But I think he felt that it was presumptuous to say people who never had the chance to even hear the gospel of Christ, that they were damned. Did you hear that? Yes.
Is that sort of in the last tale, Mary's tale, last battle, is that where the soul is symbolizing?
Yes, Emeth. Emeth means truth, actually. Emeth is one of those Calormen who had always been, at least, you know, he was a religious man, and he followed his conscience as best he could. Lewis brought him in because the words of Aslan are very, very close to, you know, other sheep I have which are not of this fold. So, though one may not hear of Christ, say, in this world, I think only through Christ can one be saved, because in the end, because heaven without Christ doesn't make any sense. But I think it would be rather like Puzzle the donkey when he gets into Narnia. Aslan had something to say to each person. We went to the donkey Puzzle. He said something which made his ears go down, and then he said something which made him go up. And I think that's going to be true of all of us.
However, we hope that you're not the only one here who believes in the historicity of Adam and Eve. If you are, we are all in a lot of trouble. We thank you so much for coming. You mentioned the fact that the readership of C.S. Lewis has multiplied several times since his passing, and I'm sure your presence here will continue that kind of statistic among the scholars at Concordia Seminary, St. Louis. We wish you well, and thank you once again for this extremely interesting lecture. Thank you.